wonderful, like feeling a surge of love, or glimpsing something perfectly beautiful, or... He struggled for words. The skill is like that, I told him softly. What you felt is the pull of it. It is what a skill user must constantly resist, lest he be swept away on it.
So that is skilling,
he observed to himself. When you first came out of it, you were ecstatic. You said something about somebody's dragon that you were to introduce. It made small sense. Let me think. Rielda's dragon, and he had promised to fly you.
Ah, my dream last night, Rielda, that was your name.
He caressed the statue's head as he spoke. When he did so, the oddest thing happened. My wit sense of the statue surged, and Nighteyes came springing to my side, every hackle on his back standing erect. I know the hair on the back of my neck stood up as well, and I recoiled, expecting the statue to suddenly stir to life. The fool shot us a puzzled glance.
What is it?
The statues seem alive to us, to both Nighteyes and me, and when you spoke that name it almost seemed to stir.
Rielda,
the fool repeated experimentally. I caught my breath as he said it, but felt no response. He glanced at me, and I shook my head.
Just stone fits. Cold and beautiful stone. I think perhaps your nerves are fraying.
He took my arm companionably, and we walked away from the statues and back to the faded trail. The others were already out of sight, save for Kettle. She stood, leaning on her stick and glaring back at us. Instinctively, I quickened my pace. When we got to the place where she waited, she took my other arm, and then imperiously waved at the fool to precede us. We followed him, but at a slower pace. When he was a substantial distance ahead of us, she squeezed my arm in a grip of steel and demanded,
"Well?"
For an instant, I looked at her blankly. Then, "I haven't worked it out yet," I apologized to her.
"That much is plain,"
she told me severely. She sucked on her teeth for a moment, frowned at me, nearly spoke, and then shook her head briskly at herself. She did not let go of my arm. For much of the rest of the day, as I walked silently by her side, I pondered the game puzzle. I do not think there is anything quite so tedious as retracing one's steps when one is desperate to get somewhere. Now that we were no longer following an ancient road near invisible in overgrowth, we followed our own trampled way back through the marshy forest and up into the hills, and made better speed leaving than we had in getting there. With the shifting of the seasons, the daylight was lingering longer, and Ketrickin pushed our march to the edge of dusk. Thus it was that we found ourselves only one hill away from the plaza of Black Stone when we made our camp that night. I think it was for my sake that Ketrickin chose to camp on the ancient road for another night. I had no desire to sleep any closer to that crossroads than I must.
"Shall we hunt?"
Nighteyes demanded, as soon as our shelter was set. "I'm going hunting," I announced to the others. Kettle glanced up disapprovingly.
"Stay well away from the skill road,"
she warned me. The fool surprised me by coming to his feet.
"I shall go with them, if the wolf doesn't mind."
"The scentless one is welcome."
"You are welcome to go with us. But are you sure you feel that strong?"
"If I get tired, I can come back,"
the fool pointed out. As we strode off into the deepening dusk, Ketrickin was poring over her map, and Kettle was on watch.
"Don't be long, or I shall come and find you,"
she warned me as I left.
"And stay away from the skill road,"
she repeated. Somewhere above the trees, a full moon sailed. Light from her crept and snaked down in silvery spills through the newly leafed branches to illuminate our way. For a time we simply travelled together through the pleasantly open woods. The wolf's senses supplemented mine. The night was alive with the smell of growing things, and the calls of tiny frogs and night insects. The night air had a crisper bite to it than the day did. We found a game trail and followed it. The fool kept pace with us, saying not a word. I breathed in deeply and then sighed it out. Despite everything else, I heard myself say, "This is good."
"Yes, it is. I shall miss it."
I knew he was thinking of what Starling had said the night before. "Let us not think of tomorrows that may never come. Let us just hunt," I suggested. And we did. The fool and I kept the trail, and the wolf veered off through the woods to spook game back toward us. We moved with the forest, sliding near noiselessly through the night, every sense alert. I came across a porcupine trundling along through the night, but I did not feel like clubbing it to death, let alone gingerly skinning it before we could eat. I wanted simple meat tonight. With great difficulty, I persuaded Night Eyes to seek other prey with me. "If we do not find anything else, we can always come back for it. They are not exactly swift of foot," I pointed out to him. He agreed grudgingly, and we quartered out again. On an open hillside, still warm from the sun, Night Eyes spotted the flick of an ear and the glint of a bright eye. In two bounds he was on top of the rabbit. His spring started another rabbit that fled toward the top of the hill. I gave chase, but the fool called out he was going back now. Halfway up the hill I knew I would not catch him. I was tired from the long day of walking, and the rabbit was in fear of its life. By the time I reached the top of the hill, it was nowhere in sight. I halted, panting. The night wind moved lightly through the trees. On it, I caught a scent, at once strange and oddly familiar. I could not identify it, but all the connotations to it were unpleasant. While I stood, nostrils flared, trying to place it, Night Eyes raced soundlessly up to me. "Be small," he ordered me. I didn't pause to think, but obeyed, crouching where I was and peering about for danger.
"No, be small in your mind."
This time I instantly grasped what he meant, and threw my skill walls up in panic. His keener nose had instantly associated the faint scent on the air with the scent of Burl's clothing in his saddlebags. I crouched as small as I could make myself and set and reset my boundaries about my mind, even as I pleaded with reality that it was next to impossible that he be here. Fear can be a powerful spur to the mind. I suddenly grasped what should always have been obvious. We were not that far from the Crossroads Plaza and the black guidepost there. The symbols carved on the guidepost columns did not merely indicate where the adjacent roads led, they also indicated where the signposts could transport one. Anywhere there was a column, one could be transported to the next column. From the ancient city to any marked location was no more than a step away. All three of them could be but steps away from me right now.
"No, there is only the one, and he is not even close to us. Use your nose, if not your brain,"
Night Eyes scathingly reassured me.
"Shall I kill him for you?"
he offered casually.
"Please. But be careful of yourself."
Night Eyes snorted softly in disdain. "He is fatter far than that wild pig I killed. He puffs and sweats just to walk down the trail. Lie still, little brother, while I get rid of him." Silent as death, the wolf moved off through the forest. I crouched an eternity, waiting to hear something, a snarl, a scream, the noises of someone running through the brush. There was nothing. I flared my nostrils but could catch no trace of the elusive scent. Suddenly I could no longer stand a crouch and wait. I surged to my feet and followed the wolf, as silently lethal as he. Before, when we had been hunting, I had not paid much attention to where we had gone. Now I perceived that we had approached closer to the Skill Road than I had suspected, that our campsite was not that far from it at all. Like a strain of distant music, I was suddenly aware of their skilling. I halted where I stood and stood still. I willed my mind to stillness and let their skill brush my senses while I made no response.
"I'm close!"
Burl, breathless with both excitement and fear. I sensed him poised and waiting.
"I feel him. He draws near."
A pause.
"Oh, I like not this place. I like it not at all."
"Be calm. A touch is all it will take. Touch him as I showed you, and his walls will come down." Will spoke. Master to apprentice.
"And if he has a knife?"
"He won't have time to use it, believe me. No man's walls can stand before that touch, I promise you. All you need do is touch him. I will come through you and do the rest."
"Why me? Why not you or Carid?"
"Would you really rather have Carid's task? Besides, you are the one who had the bastard in your power and was stupid enough to try to hold him in a cage. Go and complete the task you should have finished long ago, or would you care to feel our king's wrath again?" I felt Burl shiver, and I trembled too, for I felt for him. Regal. The thoughts were Will's, but somehow, somewhere, Regal heard them too. I wonder if Burl knew as plainly as I did that no matter whether he killed the bastard or not, Regal would enjoy giving him pain again. That the memory of torturing him was so pleasurable a one that Regal could no longer think of him at all without being reminded of how completely it had satisfied him. Briefly. I was glad I was not Burl.
There! That was the bastard! Find him!
I should have died then by all rights. Will found me. Had found my careless thought floating in the air. My brief sympathy for Burl was all it had taken. He bayed on my trail like a hound.
"I have him!"
There was a moment of poised tension. My heart hammered against my ribs as I sent the wit questing out all around me. Nothing bigger than a mouse was close by. I found Night Eyes down the hill from me, moving with swift stealth, yet Burl had said he drew near to me. Had he found a way to shield himself from my wit sense? The thought made my knees weak. Somewhere far down the hill, I heard the crash of a body through brush and a man's shout. The wolf was on him, I thought.
"No, brother, not I."
I could scarcely understand the wolf's thought. I reeled with a skill impact, yet could feel no source for it. My senses contradicted each other, as if I plunged into water and felt it as sand. With no clear idea of what I did, I began a shambling run down the hill.
"This is not him!"
Will, in great anger and agitation.
"What is this? Who is this?"
A pause of consternation.
"It's that freak thing, the fool!"
Then vast anger.
"Where is the bastard? Burl, you clumsy moron! You have betrayed us all to him!"
But it was not I, but Night Eyes who charged down on Burl. Even at my distance I could hear his snarls. In the dark woods below, a wolf launched himself at Burl, and the skill shriek he sent up at the sight of those ravening jaws, coming toward his face, was such that Will was distracted. In that instant, I slammed up my walls and raced to join my wolf in the physical attack on Burl. I was doomed to disappointment. They were much farther away than I had thought them. I never even got a glimpse of Burl, save through the wolf's eyes. Fat and clumsy as the wolf might think Burl, he proved an excellent runner when the wolf was at his heels. Even so, Night Eyes would have pulled him down if he had had any farther to go than he did. At his first spring, Night Eyes got only his cloak as Burl spun. His second attack tore legging and flesh, but Burl fled as if uninjured. Night Eyes saw him reach the edge of the brick-flagged plaza and race up to the column, one hand outstretched pleadingly. His palm slapped the shining stone, and Burl suddenly vanished into the column. The wolf braced his legs to halt, his feet skittering on the slick stone. He cowered back from the standing stone, as if Burl had leaped into a blazing bonfire. He halted a handspan from it, snarling furiously, not only in anger but in savage fear. All this I knew, although I was a hillside away, running and stumbling in the dark. Suddenly, there was a wave of skill. It made no physical manifestation, yet the impact flung me to the ground and drove the breath out of me. It left me dazed, ears ringing, helplessly open to anyone who might wish to possess me. I lay there, sick and stunned. Perhaps that was what saved me, that at that moment I felt absolutely no trace of skill within myself. But I heard the others. There was no sense to their skilling, only awestruck fear. Then they faded in the distance, as if the skill river itself washed them away. I almost went reaching after them, in my amazement at what I sensed. They seemed to have been shattered to fragments, their dwindling bewilderment washed against me. I closed my eyes. Then I heard Kettle's voice frantically calling my name. Panic strained her voice. Night Eyes! I'm already on my way. Catch up, the wolf told me grimly. I did as I was told. I was scratched and dirty, and one trouser leg was torn at the knee when I reached the yurt. Kettle was standing outside it, waiting for me. The fire had been built up as a beacon. At the sight of her, the pounding of my heart lessened somewhat. I'd half believed that they were being attacked. What's wrong? I demanded, as I charged up to her. The fool, she said, and added. We heard an outcry and raced outside. Then I heard the wolf snarling. We went toward the sound and found the fool. She shook her head. I am not sure what has happened to him. I started to push past her into the tent, but she caught me by the arm. She was surprisingly strong for an old woman. She halted me to face her. You were attacked? She demanded. In a way. Briefly I told her what had happened. Her eyes widened as I spoke of that skill wave. When I was finished, she nodded to herself, grimly confirming her suspicions. They reached for you, and you seized him instead. He has not the faintest idea of how to protect himself. For all I know, they have him still.
What? How?
I asked numbly.
Back there at the plaza. You two were skill-linked, however briefly, by the strength of the stone and the strength of who you are. It leaves a sort of a path. The more often two are linked, the stronger it becomes. With frequency, it becomes a bond, like a coterie bond. Others who are skilled can see such bonds if they look for them. Often they are like back doors, unguarded ways into a skilled one's mind. This time, however, I would say they found the fool in your stead.
The look on my face made her let go my arm. I pushed my way into the tent. There was a tiny fire burning in the brazier. Ketrickin knelt by the fool, speaking to him low and earnestly. Starling sat unmoving in her bedding, pale and staring at him, while the wolf restlessly prowled the crowded interior of the tent. His hackles still stood high. I went quickly to kneel by the fool. At first glimpse of him I recoiled. I had expected him to lie limply unconscious. Instead he was rigid, his eyes open and his eyeballs twitching about as if he watched some terrible struggle we could not witness. I touched his arm. The rigidity of his muscles and the coolness of his body reminded me of a corpse.
Fool?
I asked him. He gave no sign at all of hearing me.
Fool!
I cried louder and leaned over him. I shook him, lightly at first, and then more violently. It had no effect.
Touch him, and skill to him.
Ketrickin instructed me gruffly, but be careful.
If they still have him, you put yourself at risk as well.
It shames me to say that I froze for an instant. As much as I loved the fool, I feared Will still. I reached, at last, a second and an eternity later, to put my hand on his brow.
Don't be afraid,
Kettle told me uselessly, and then added that which almost paralyzed me.
If they have him and hold him still, it is only a matter of time before they use the link between you to take you as well. Your only choice is to battle them from his mind. Go on now.
She set her hand to my shoulder, and for one eerie moment, it was Shrewd's hand on my shoulder, drawing skill strength from me. She gave me a reassuring little pat. I closed my eyes, felt the fool's brow under my hand. I dropped my skill walls. The skill river flowed, full to flood time, and I fell into it. A moment to gain orientation. I knew an instant of terror as I sensed Will and Burl at the very edges of my perception. They were in great agitation about something. I recoiled from them as if I had brushed a hot stove and narrowed my focus. The fool, the fool, only the fool. I sought for him. I almost found him. Oh, he was passing strange and surpassing strange. He darted and eluded me like a bright gold carp in a weedy pool, like the motes that dance before one's eyes after being dazzled by the sun. As well to clutch at a moon's reflection in a still midnight pond as to seek a grip on that bright mind. I knew his beauty and his power in the briefest flashes of insight. In a moment I understood and marveled at all that he was, and in the next I had forgotten that understanding. Then, with an insight worthy of the stone game, I knew what to do. Rather than attempt to seize him, I surrounded him. I made no effort to invade or capture, but simply to encompass all that I saw of him and hold it separate from harm. It reminded me of when I had first been learning to skill. Often, Verity had done this for me, helping me contain myself when the current of the skill threatened to spill me wide to the world. I steadied the fool as he gathered himself back to himself. I suddenly felt a cool clasping of my wrist.
"Stop it!" he begged gently. "Please!"
he added, and it smote me that he thought he needed that word. I withdrew from my seeking and opened my eyes. I blinked a few times and then was surprised to find myself shivering with the cold sweat that cloaked me. It was impossible for the fool to look any paler than he always was, but there was a tentative look in his eyes and mouth, as if he were not sure he was awake. My eyes met his, and I felt almost a jolt of awareness of him, a skill bond, thin as a thread. But there, had not my nerves been so raw from reaching after him, I probably would not have felt it at all.
"I did not like that,"
he said quietly. "I am sorry," I told him gently. "I thought they had hold of you, so I went seeking you." He waved a hand freely.
"Oh, not you, I meant the others."
He swallowed as if sickened.
"They were within me, in my mind, in my memories, smashing and befouling like evil, lawless children. They—"
His eyes went glossy. "Was it Burl?" I suggested gently.
"Ah, yes. That is his name, though he scarce remembers it himself these days. Will and Regal have taken him over for their own uses. They came through him into me, thinking they had found you."
His voice dwindled off.
"Or so it seems. How could I know such a thing? The skill brings strange insights. They cannot overcome your mind without showing much of their own."
Kettle informed him grudgingly. She took a small pot of steaming water off the brazier. To me she added,
"Give me your elf bark."
I immediately reached for my pack to dig it out, but I could not resist asking her chidingly. I thought you said the herb was not beneficial.
It isn't, she said tersely. For skill users. But for him it may give him the protection he cannot provide for himself. They will try this again, I do not doubt. If they can invade him, even for a moment, they will use him to find you. It is an old trick.
One I have never heard of, I pointed out, as I handed her my bag of elf bark. She shook some into a cup and added boiling water. Then she calmly put my bag of herbs into her pack. It was obviously not an oversight, but I dismissed it as useless, asking for them back.
How do you know so much about skill matters?
The fool asked her pointedly. He was recovering some of his spirit.
Perhaps I learned by listening instead of asking personal questions all the time,
she snapped at him.
Now, you are going to drink this, she added,
as if she regarded the topic as settled. If I had not been so anxious, it would have been humorous to see the fool so deftly quelled. The fool took the cup, but looked over at me.
What was that that happened at the last? They held me, and then suddenly it was all earthquake and flood and fire at once.
He knit his brow.
And then I was gone, scattered. I could not find myself. Then you came.
Would anyone care to explain to me what has happened this night? Ketterikin asked a bit testily. I half expected Kettle to answer, but she kept silent. The fool lowered his mug of tea.
It's a hard thing to explain, my queen, like two ruffians bursting into your bedchamber, dragging you from your bed and shaking you, all the while calling you by another's name. And when they discovered I was not the Fitz, they were very angry with me. Then came the earthquake, and I was dropped, down several flights of stairs, metaphorically speaking, of course.
They let you go? I asked delightedly. I instantly turned to Kettle. They are not as clever as you feared, then. Kettle scowled at me.
Nor are you as clever as I had hoped,
she muttered darkly.
Did they let him go, or did a skill blast shake them loose? And if so, whose power was that?
Verity, I said with sudden certainty. Comprehension washed over me. They attacked Verity tonight as well, and he defeated them. Of what do you speak? Ketterikin demanded in her queen's voice. Who attacked my king? What knowledge of these others who attacked the fool does Kettle have? No personal knowledge, my lady, I assure you, I declared hastily.
Oh, do shut up!
Kettle snapped at me.
My queen, I have a scholar's knowledge, if you will, of one who has studied but cannot do a thing. Since Prophet and Catalyst were joined for that moment back in the plaza, I feared they might share a bond the skill users could turn against them, but either the coterie does not know this, or something distracted them tonight. Perhaps the skill wave that Fitz spoke of.
The skill wave? You believe it was Verity's doing? Ketrickin's breath was suddenly swift, her color heightened. Only from him have I ever felt such strength, I told her. Then he lives, she said softly. He lives.
Perhaps, said Kettle sourly. To blast with skill, like that can kill a man. And it may not have been Verity at all. It may have been a failed effort by Will and Regal to get at Fitz.
No, I told you. It scattered them like chaff in a wind.
And I told you, they may have destroyed themselves in trying to kill you.
I had thought that Ketterikin would chide her, but both she and Starling stared wide-eyed in astonishment on Kettle's sudden professing of skill knowledge.
How kind of you both to have warned me so well,
the fool said with acid courtesy. I didn't know, I began my protest, but again Kettle overrode me.
It would have done no good to warn you, save to put your mind to dwelling on it. We can make this comparison. It has taken all our combined effort to keep the Fitz both focused and sane on the Skill Road. He would never have survived his journey into the city had not his senses been numbed with elf bark first. Yet these others travel the road and use the skill beacons freely. Obviously their strength overmatches his by much. Ah, what to do, what to do?
No one replied to her questioning of herself. She looked up suddenly at the fool and me accusingly.
This cannot be right. It simply cannot be right. The prophet and the catalyst, and you are scarcely more than boys, green to manhood, untrained in skill, full of pranks and lovesick woes. These are the ones sent to save the world?
The fool and I exchanged glances, and I saw him take a breath to reply her, but at that moment, Starling snapped her fingers. "And that is what makes a song!" she exclaimed suddenly, her face transfigured with delight. "Not a song of heroic strength and mighty thewed warriors, no! A song of two, graced only with friendship's strength, each possessed of a loyalty to a king that would not be denied, and that in the refrain... Green of manhood, something, The fool caught my eye, glanced meaningfully down at himself.
Green manhood? I really should have showed her, he said quietly.
And despite everything, despite even the glowering of my queen, I burst out laughing.
Stop it!
Kettle rebuked us, with such discouragement in her voice that I was instantly sober.
It is neither the time for songs nor knavery. Are you both too foolish to see the danger you are in? The danger you put all of us in with your vulnerability?
I watched her as she reluctantly took my elf bark out of her pack again and put her kettle back to boil.
It is the only thing I can think of to do.
She apologized to Ketrickon.
What is that?
She asked.
To drug the fool at least with elf bark. It will deafen him to them, and hide his thoughts from them.
Elf bark doesn't work like that, I objected indignantly.
Doesn't it?
Kettle turned on me fiercely.
Then why was it used traditionally for years for just that purpose? Given to a royal bastard young enough, it could destroy any potential for skill use. Often enough was that done.
I shook my head defiantly. I've used it for years, to restore my strength after skilling, so has Verity, and it has never—
Sweet Eda's mercy!
Kettle exclaimed.
Tell me you are lying, please.
Why should I lie about this? Elf bark revives a man's strength, though it may bring on melancholy spirits following use. Often I would carry elf bark tea up to Verity in his skill tower to sustain him. My telling faltered. The dismay on Kettle's face was too sincere.
What?
I asked softly.
Elf bark is well known among skilled ones as a thing to avoid, she said quietly.
I heard every word, for no one in the tent even seemed to be breathing.
It deadens a man to skill, so that he can neither use the skill himself, nor may others reach through its fog to skill to him. It is said to stunt or destroy skill talent in the young, and to impede its development in older skill users.
She looked at me with pity in her eyes.
You must have been strongly talented once, to retain even a semblance of skilling.
It cannot be, I said faintly.
Think.
She bade me.
Did you ever feel your skill strength wax strong after using it?
What of my Lord Verity? Ketrickon suddenly demanded. Kettle shrugged reluctantly. She turned to me.
When did he start using it?
It was hard for me to focus my mind on her words. So many things were suddenly in a different light. Elfbark had always cleared my head of the pounding that heavy skilling brought on. But I had never tried to skill immediately after I had used elf bark. Verity had, I knew that. But how successfully, I did not know. My erratic talent for skilling Could that have been my elf-bark use? Like a lightning bolt that was the immense knowledge that Chade had made a mistake in giving it to Verity and me. Chade had made a mistake. It had never occurred to me somehow that Chade could be wrong or mistaken. Chade was my master. Chade read and studied and knew all the old lore. But he had never been taught to skill. A bastard like myself, he had never been taught to skill. Fitzchivalry! Ketrickin's command jerked me back to myself. So far as I know, Verity began to use it in the early years of the war, when he was the only skill user to stand between us and the red ships. I believe he had never used the skill so intensely as then, nor been as exhausted by it, so Chade began to give him Elfbark to keep up his strength. Kettle blinked a few times.
Unused, the skill does not develop,
she said, almost to herself.
Used, it grows and begins to assert itself, and one learns almost instinctively the many uses to which it may be put.
I found myself nodding faintly to her soft words. Her old eyes came up suddenly to meet mine. She spoke without reservation.
You are most likely stunted, both of you, by the Elfbark. Verity, as a man, grown, may have recovered. He may have seen his skill grow in the time he has spent away from the herb. As you seem to have. Certainly he seems to have mastered the road alone.
She sighed.
But I suspect those others have not used it, and their talents and usage of skill had grown and outstripped what yours is. So now you have a choice, Fitzchivalry. And only you can make it. The fool has nothing to lose by using the drug. He cannot skill, and by using it, he may keep the coterie from finding him again. But you? I can give you this, and it will deaden you to the skill. It will be harder for them to reach you, and much harder for you to reach out. You might be safer that way. But you will be once more thwarting your talent. Enough Elfbark may kill it off completely, and only you can choose.
I looked down at my hands. Then I looked up at the fool. Once more our eyes met. Hesitantly, I groped toward him with my skill. I felt nothing. Perhaps it was only my own erratic talent cheating me again, but it seemed likely to me that Kettle had been right. The Elfbark the fool had just drunk had deadened him to me. As Kettle spoke, she had been taking the kettle from the fire. The fool held his cup out to her wordlessly. She gave him a pinch more of the bitter bark and filled it again with water. Then she looked at me, quietly waiting. I looked at the faces watching me, but found no help there. I picked up a mug from the stacked crockery. I saw Kettle's old face darken and her lips tighten, but she said nothing to me. She simply reached into the pouch of Elfbark, working her fingers to get to the bottom where the bark had crushed itself into powder. I looked into the empty mug, waiting. I glanced back up at Kettle. You said the skill blast might have destroyed them? Kettle shook her head slowly.
It is not a thing to count on.
There was nothing I could count on. Nothing that was certain. Then I set the mug down and crawled over to my blankets. I was suddenly, tremendously weary, and frightened. I knew Will was out there, somewhere, seeking me. I could hide myself in Elfbark, but it might not be enough to stave him off. It might only weaken my already stunted defenses against him. Abruptly, I knew I would sleep not at all that night. I'll take the watch. I offered, and stood again.
He should not stand alone,
Kettle said grumpily. His wolf watches with him. Ketrickin told her confidently. He can aid Fitz against this false coterie, as no one else can. I wondered how she knew that, but dared not ask her. Instead, I took up my cloak and went to stand outside by the dwindling fire, watching and waiting like a condemned man.
32. Capelin Beach. The wit is held in much disdain. In many areas it is regarded as a perversion, with tales told of witted ones coupling with beasts to gain this magic, or offering blood sacrifice of human children to gain the gift of the tongues of beasts and birds. Some tale-tellers speak of bargains struck with ancient demons of the earth. In truth, I believe the wit is as natural a magic as a man can claim. It is the wit that lets a flock of birds in flight suddenly wheel as one, or a school of fingerlings hold place together in a swiftly flowing stream. It is also the wit that sends a mother to her child's bedside, just as the babe is waking. I believe it is at the heart of all wordless communication, and that all humans possess some small aptitude for it, recognized or not. The next day we once again reached the Skill Road. As we trailed past the forbidding pillar of stone, I felt myself drawn to it.
Verity may be but one stride away from me,
I said quietly. Kettle snorted.
Or your death? Have you taken complete leave of your senses? Do you think any one skill user could stand against a trained coterie?
Verity did, I replied, thinking of Tradeford and how he had saved me. The rest of that morning she walked with a thoughtful look on her face. I did not endeavour to get her to speak, for I carried a burden of my own. I felt within me a nagging sense of loss. It was almost the irritating sensation of knowing one had forgotten something, but was unable to recall what. I had left something behind, or I had forgotten to do something important, something I had been intending to do. By late afternoon, with a sinking feeling, I grasped what was missing. Verity. When he had been with me, I had seldom been sure of his presence. Like a hidden seed, waiting to unfurl was how I had thought of him. The many times I had sought him within myself and failed to find him suddenly meant nothing. This was not a doubt or a wondering. This was a growing certainty. Verity had been with me for over a year. And now? He was gone. Did it mean he was dead? I could not be certain. That immense wave of skill I had felt could have been him, or something else, something that had forced him to withdraw into himself. That was probably all it was. It was a miracle that his skill touch upon me had lasted as long as it had. Several times I started to speak of it to Kettle, or Ketrickin. Each time I could not justify it. What would I say? Before this I could tell if Verity was with me, and now I cannot feel him at all? At night, by our fires, I studied the lines in Ketrickin's face and asked myself what point there was in increasing her worry. So I pushed my worries down and kept silent. Continuous hardship makes for monotony and days that run together in the telling. The weather was rainy in a fitful, windy way. Our supplies were precariously low, so that the greens we could gather as we walked and whatever meat Night Eyes and I could bring down at night became important to us. I walked beside the road instead of on it, but remained constantly aware of its skill murmur, like the muttering of a river of water beside me. The fool was kept well dosed with elf bark tea. Very soon he began to exhibit both the boundless energy and bleak spirits that were elf bark's properties. In the fool's case, it meant endless cavorting and tumbling tricks as we made our way along the Skill Road, and a cruelly bitter edge to his wits and tongue. He jested all too often of the futility of our quest, and to any encouraging remark he riposted with savage sarcasm. By the end of the second day he reminded me of nothing so much as an ill-mannered child. He heeded no one's rebukes, not even Ketrickin's, nor did he recall that silence could be a virtue. It was not so much that I feared his endless prattle and edged songs would bring the coterie down on us, as that I worried his constant noise might mask their approach. Pleading with him to be quiet did me as little good as roaring at him to shut up. He wore on my nerves until I dreamed of throttling him, nor did I think I was alone in that impulse. The kinder weather was the only way in which our lot improved on those long days as we followed the Skill Road. The rain became lighter and more intermittent. The leaves opened on the deciduous trees that flanked the road, and the hills about us greened almost overnight. The health of the Jeppas improved with the browse, and Night Eyes found plentiful small game. The shorter hours of sleep told on me, but letting the wolf hunt alone would not have solved it. I feared to sleep any more. Worse, Kettle feared to let me sleep. Of her own accord, the old woman took charge of my mind. I resented it, but I was not so stupid as to resist. Both Ketrickin and Starling had accepted her knowledge of the skill. I was no longer permitted to go off alone, or in the sole company of the fool. When the wolf and I hunted at night, Ketrickin went with us. Starling and I shared a watch, during which, at Kettle's urging, she kept my mind busy with learning to recite both songs and stories from Starling's repertoire. During my brief hours of sleep, Kettle watched over me, a dark stewing of elf bark at her elbow where, if need be, she could pour it down my throat and douse my skill. All of this was annoying, and worst was during the day when we walked together. I was not allowed to speak of Verity, or the coterie, or anything that might touch upon them. Instead, we worked at game problems, or gathered wayside herbs for the evening meal, or I recited Starling's stories for her. At any time when she suspected my mind was not fully with her, she might give me a sharp rap with her walking stick. The few times I tried to direct our talk with questions about her past, she loftily informed me that it might lead to the very topics we must avoid. There is no more slippery task than to refrain from thinking of something. In the midst of my busy work, the fragrance of a wayside flower would bring Molly to my mind, and from thence to Verity, who had called me away from her, was but a skip of a thought. Or some chance muttering of the fool would call to my thoughts King Shrewd's tolerance for his mockery, and recall to me how my king had died, and at whose hands. Worst of all was Ketrickin's silence. She could no longer speak to me of her anxiety over Verity. I could not see her without feeling how she longed to find him, and then rebuked myself for thinking of him. And so the long days of our travelling passed for me. Gradually, the countryside around us changed. We found ourselves descending deeper and deeper into valley after winding valley. For a time our road paralleled that of a milky grey river. In places, its rising and fallings had gnawed the road at its side to no more than a footpath. We came at length to an immense bridge. When we first glimpsed it from a distance, the spider-web delicacy of its span reminded me of bones, and I feared that we would find it reduced to splintered fragments of reaching timbers. Instead, we crossed on a creation that arched over the river needlessly high, as if in joy that it could. The road we crossed on shone black and shining, while the archwork that graced above and below the span was a powdery grey. I could not identify what it was wrought from, whether true metal or strange stone, for it had more the look of a spun thread than hammered metal or chiselled rock. The elegance and grace of it stilled even the fool for a time. After the bridge, we climbed a series of small hills, only to begin another descent. This time the valley was narrow and deep, a steeply sided cleft in the earth,
as if some giant had long ago cleaved it with a war axe. The road clung to one side of it, and followed it inexorably down. We could see little of where we were going, for the valley itself seemed full of clouds and greenery. This puzzled me until the first rivulet of warm water cut our pathway. It bubbled up steamily from a spring right beside the road, but had long ago disdained the ornately carved stone walls and drainage channel some vanished engineer had placed to contain it. The fool made great show of considering its stench, and whether it should be attributed to rotten eggs or some flatulence of the earth itself. For once, not even his rudeness could make me smile. It was for me as if his knavery had gone on too long, the merriment fled, and only the crudity and cruelty left. We came, in early afternoon, to a region of steaming pools. The lure of hot water was too much to resist, and Kettrickin let us make camp early. We had the long-missed comfort of hot water for soaking our weary bodies in, though the fool disdained it because of its smell. To me, it smelled no worse than the steaming waters that rose to feed the baths in Jampe. But for once, I was just as glad to forego his company. He went off in search of more potable water, while the women took over the largest pool, and I sought out the relative privacy of a smaller one at some distance. I soaked for a time, and then decided to pound some of the dirt from my clothing. The mineral stink of the water was far less than the odor my own body had left on them. That done, I spread my garments on the grass to dry, and went to lie once more in the water. Night Eyes came to sit on the bank, and watch me in puzzlement, his tail tucked neatly around his feet. "It feels good," I told him needlessly, for I knew he could sense my pleasure. "It must have something to do with your lack of fur," he decided at last. "Come in, and I'll scrub you off. It would help you shed off your winter undercoat," I offered him. He gave a disdainful sniff. "I think I'd prefer to scratch it off a bit at a time."
"Well, you needn't sit and watch me and be bored. Go hunting if you wish."
"I would, but the high bitch has asked me to watch you, so I shall."
"Kettrickin?"
"So you name her."
"How?" asked you.
He gave me a puzzled glance. "As you would. She looked at me and I knew her mind. She worried that you were alone."
"Does she know you hear her? Does she hear you?"
"Almost at times."
He lay down abruptly on the sward and stretched, curling his pink tongue.
"Perhaps when your mate bids you set me aside, I shall bond to her."
"Not funny." He made no reply to me but rolled over onto his back and proceeded to roll about, scratching his back. The topic of Molly was now an edge of uneasiness between us, a rift I dared not approach, and one he obsessively peered into. I wished abruptly that we were as we once had been, joined and whole, living only in the now. I leaned back, resting my head on the bank, half in and half out of the water. I closed my eyes and thought of nothing. When I opened them again, the fool was standing looking down at me. I started visibly. So did Night Eyes, springing to his feet with a growl.
"Some guardian," I observed to the fool. "He has no scent, and walks lighter than falling snow,"
the wolf complained.
"He is always with you, isn't he?"
the fool observed.
"One way or the other," I agreed, and lay back in the water. I would have to get out soon. The late afternoon was becoming evening.
The additional chill in the air only made the hot water more soothing. After a moment, I glanced over at the fool. He was just standing and staring at me.
"Is something wrong?" I asked him.
He made an inconclusive gesture and then sat down awkwardly on the bank.
"I've been thinking about your candlemaker girl,"
he said suddenly.
"Have you?"
I asked quietly. I've been doing my best not to. He thought about this for a bit.
If you die, what will become of her?
I rolled over on my belly and propped myself on my elbows to stare at the fool. I half expected this was the lead line to some new mockery of his. But his face was grave. Burridge will take care of her, I said quietly. For as long as she needs help. She's a capable woman, fool. After a moment's consideration, I added, she took care of herself for years before. Fool, I've never really taken care of her. I was near her, but she always stood on her own. I felt both shamed and proud as I said that. Shamed that I had given her so little besides trouble, and proud that such a woman had cared for me.
But you would at least want me to take word to her, would you not?
I shook my head slowly. She believes me dead. They both do. If in fact I die, I'd just as soon let her believe I died in Regal's dungeons. For her to learn otherwise would only tar me blacker in her eyes. How could you explain to her that I did not come to her immediately? No. If something happens to me, I wish no tales told her. Bleakness gripped me once more, and if I survived and went back to her, that was almost worse to consider. I tried to imagine standing before her and explaining to her that, once more, I had put my king ahead of her. I clenched my eyes tight shut at the thought of it.
Still, when all this is done and gone, I should like to see her again,
the fool observed. I opened my eyes. You? I did not know that you had even spoken to one another. The fool seemed a bit taken aback at this.
But that is, I meant for your sake, to see for myself that she is well provided for.
I felt oddly touched. I don't know what to say, I told him.
Say nothing, then. Tell me only where I may find her,
he suggested with a smile. I don't precisely know that myself, I admitted to him. Chade knows. If I do not live through what we must do, ask it of him. It felt unlucky to speak of my own death, so I added, of course, we both know we shall survive. It is foretold, is it not? He gave me an odd look.
By whom?
My heart sank. By some white prophet or other, I had hoped, I muttered. It occurred to me that I had never asked the fool if my survival was foretold. Not every man survives winning a battle. I found my courage. Is it foretold that the catalyst lives? He appeared to be thinking hard. He suddenly observed,
Chade leads a dangerous life. There is no assurance that he will survive either, and if he does not, well, surely you must have some idea of where the girl is. Will you not tell me?
That he had not answered my question seemed suddenly answer enough. The catalyst did not survive. It was like being hit by a wave of cold salt water. I felt tumbled in that cold knowledge, drowning in it. I'd never hold my daughter. Never feel Molly's warmth again. It was almost a physical pain. And it dizzied me.
Fitzchivalry?
The fool pressed me. He lifted a hand to suddenly cover his mouth lightly, as if he could speak no more. His other hand rose to grip his wrist suddenly. He looked sickened. It's all right, I said faintly. Perhaps it's better that I know what is to come. I sighed and racked my brain. I've heard them speak of a village. Burridge goes there to buy things. It cannot be far. You could start there. The fool gave a tiny nod of encouragement to me. Tears stood in his eyes. Capelin Beach. I said quietly. A moment longer he sat staring at me. Then he suddenly toppled over sideways. Fool? There was no response. I stood, the warm water running off me,
and looked over at him. He sprawled on his side as if asleep.
"Fool!"
I called irritably. When there was still no response, I waded out of the pond and over to him. He lay on the grassy bank, miming the deep, even breathing of sleep.
"Fool?"
I asked again, half expecting him to come leaping up in my face. Instead, he made a vague motion as if I disturbed his dreaming. It irritated me beyond words that he could go so abruptly from serious words to some kind of knavery, yet it was typical of his behavior over the past few days. There was suddenly no relaxation or peace left in the hot water. Still dripping, I began to gather my clothes. I refused to look at him as I brushed and shook most of the water from my body. The clothing I pulled on was slightly damp anyway. The fool slept on as I turned away from him and walked back to the camp. Night Eyes trailed at my heels.
"Is it a game?"
he asked me as we walked. "Of a kind, I suppose," I told him shortly. "Not one I enjoy." The women were already back at the camp. Ketrigan was poring over her map while Kettle gave the Jeppas tiny shares of the remaining grain. Starling was sitting by the fire, worrying a comb through her hair, but looked up as I approached.
"Did the fool find clean water?" she asked me.
I shrugged. "Not when I saw him last. At least if he had, he wasn't carrying it with him.
We've enough in the water skins to get by with anyway. I just prefer fresh for the tea."
"Me too." I sat down by the cook fire and watched her. She seemed to give no thought to her fingers at all as they danced over her hair, binding the wet, shining hair into smooth braids. She collected them to her head and pinned them down securely.
"I hate wet hair flopping around my face," she observed,
and I realized I'd been staring. I glanced away, embarrassed.
"He can still blush," she laughed.
Then added pointedly, "Would you like to borrow my comb?" I lifted my hand to my own draggled hair.
"I suppose I should,"
I muttered.
"Truly,"
she agreed, but did not pass it to me. Instead, she came to kneel behind me.
"How did you do all this?"
she wondered aloud as she began to tug the comb through it.
"It just gets that way,"
I mumbled. Her gentle touch, the soft tugging at my scalp, felt incredibly good.
"It's so fine, that's the problem.
I never met a buck man with hair so fine." My heart moved sideways in my chest. A buck beach on a windy day, and Molly on a red blanket beside me, her blouse not quite laced. She had told me I was considered the best thing to have come out of the stable since Burridge.
"I think it is your hair. It is not as coarse as most buckmen's."
One brief interlude of flirtatious compliments and idle talk and her sweet touch under the open sky. I almost smiled. But I could not recall that day without also recalling that, like so many of our times together, it had ended in quarreling and tears. My throat closed up and I shook my head, trying to clear the memories away.
"Sit still,"
Starling chided me, with a sharper tug on my hair.
"I've almost got it smooth. Brace yourself. This is the last snarl."
She caught hold of my hair above it and ripped out the snarl with a swift jerk that I almost didn't feel.
"Give me the thong,"
she told me, and took it from me to bind my hair back for me. Kettle came back from tending the Jeppas.
"Any meat?"
she asked me pointedly. I sighed.
"Not yet. Soon," I promised.
I hauled myself to my feet, wearily.
"Watch him, Wolf,"
Kettle asked Night Eyes. He gave a slight wag of his tail and then led me away from the camp. It was past dark when we returned to the camp. We were well pleased with ourselves, for we brought not rabbit, but a cloven-hoofed creature rather like a small kid, but with a silkier hide. I had opened its belly at the kill site, both to let Night Eyes have the entrails, and to lighten it for carrying. I slung the meat over my shoulder, but regretted that after a short time. Whatever biting vermin it had been carrying were only too happy to transfer to my neck. I would have to wash myself again this night. I grinned at Kettle as she came to meet me, and unslung the kid to hold it up for her inspection. But instead of congratulations, she only demanded,
"Have you any more elf bark?"
"I gave you all I had," I told her. "Why, have we run out?" The way it makes the fool behave, I'd almost welcome that news. She gave me an odd look.
"Did you quarrel?"
she demanded.
"Did you strike him?"
"What? Of course not."
"We found him by the pool where you bathed," she said quietly, "twitching in his sleep like a dreaming dog. I woke him, but even awake he seemed vague. We brought him back here, but he only sought his blankets. Since then, he has been sleeping like a dead thing."
We had reached the cook fire, and I dropped the kid beside it and hurried into the tent, Night Eyes pursuing his way in front of me.
"He revived, but only for a bit," Kettle continued. "Then he dropped off to sleep again. He behaves like a man recovering from exhaustion or a very long illness. I fear for him."
I scarcely heard her. Once in the tent, I dropped to my knees beside him. He lay on his side, curled in a ball. Ketrickin knelt by him, her face clouded with worry. He looked to me simply like a man sleeping. Relief warred with irritation in me.
"I've given him almost all the elf bark,"
Kettle was going on.
"If I give him what's left now, we have no reserves if the coterie tries to attack him."
"Is there no other herb?" Ketrickin began, but I interrupted her. "Why don't we simply let him sleep? Perhaps this is just the end of his other illness, or maybe an effect of the elf bark itself. Even with potent drugs, one can only trick the body so long and then it makes its demands known."
"That is true,"
Kettle agreed reluctantly.
"But this is so unlike him."
"He has been unlike himself since the third day he was using elf bark," I pointed out. "His tongue too sharp, his jibes too cutting. If you ask me, I would say I prefer him asleep to awake these days."
"Well, perhaps there is something to what you say. We will let him sleep then,"
Kettle conceded. She took a breath, as if to say more, but did not. I went back outside to prepare the kid for cooking. Starling followed me. For a time she just sat silently watching me skin it out. It was not that large an animal. "Help me build up a fire and we'll roast the whole thing. Cooked meat will keep better in this weather."
"The whole thing?"
"Except a generous portion for you." I worked my knife around a knee point, snapped the shank free, and cut the remaining gristle.
"I want more than bones,"
Night Eyes reminded me.
"Trust me," I told him.
By the time I was finished, he had the head, hide, all four shanks, and one hind quarter to himself. It made it awkward to fasten the meat to a spit, but I managed. It was a young animal, and though it did not have much fat, I expected the meat would be tender. The hardest part would be waiting for it to be cooked. The flames licked their tips against it, searing it, and the savory smell of roasting meat taunted me.
"Are you so angry with the fool?"
Starling asked me quietly.
"What?"
I glanced over my shoulder at her. "In the time we have traveled together, I have come to see how you are with one another. Closer than brothers. I would have expected you to sit beside him and fret as you did when he was ill. Yet you behave as if nothing is wrong with him at all."
"Minstrels, perhaps, see too clearly."
I pushed my hair back from my face and thought. "Earlier today he came to me and we talked about what he would do for Molly if I did not live to return to her." I looked at Starling and shook my head. When my throat went tight, it surprised me. "He does not expect me to survive. And when a prophet says such a thing, it is hard to believe otherwise.
The look of dismay on her face was not comforting. It gave the lie to her words when she insisted. Prophets are not always right. Did he say for certain that he had seen your death? When I asked him, he would not answer. I replied. He should not have even brought up such a topic. Starling suddenly exclaimed angrily. How can he expect you to have heart for whatever you must do when you believe it will be your death? I shrugged my shoulders at her silently. I had refused to think of it the whole time we had been hunting, instead of going away. The feelings had only built up. The misery I suddenly felt was overwhelming, yes, and the anger too. I was furious at the fool for telling me. I forced myself to consider it. The tidings are scarcely his doing. And I cannot fault his intent. Yet it is hard to face one's death, not as a thing that will happen some day, somewhere, but as something that will likely occur before this summer loses its green. I lifted my head and looked around the verdant, wild meadow that surrounded us. It is amazing how different a thing appears when you know it is the last one you will have. Every leaf on every limb stood out in a multitude of greens. Birds sang challenges to one another, or winged by in flashes of color. The smells of the cooking meat, of the earth itself, even the sound of Night-Eyes cracking a bone between his jaws, were all suddenly unique and precious things. How many days like this had I walked through blindly, intent only on having a mug of ale when I got to town, or what horse must be taken for shoeing today? Long ago, in Buckkeep, the fool had warned me that I should live each day as if it were significant, as if every day the fate of this world depended on my actions. Now I suddenly grasped what he had been trying to tell me. Now, when the days left to me had dwindled to where I might count them. Starling put her hands on my shoulders. She leaned down and put her cheek against me.
"Fitz, I am so sorry,"
she said quietly. I scarcely heard her words, only her belief in my death. I stared at the meat cooking over the flames. It had been a live kid.
"Death is always at the edge of now,"
Night-Eye's thought was gentle.
"Death stalks us, and he is ever sure of his kill. It is not a thing to dwell on, but it is something we all know in our guts and bones. All save humans."
With shock, I beheld what the fool had been trying to teach me about time. I suddenly wished to go back, to have again each separate day to spend. Time. I was trapped in it, fenced into a tiny piece of now that was the only time I could influence. All the soons and tomorrows I might plan were ghost things that might be snatched from me at any moment. Intentions were nothing. Now was all I had. I suddenly stood up. "I understand," I said aloud. "He had to tell me to push me. I have to stop acting as if there is no tomorrow when I can put things right. It has to be done now, right away, with no concern for tomorrow, no belief in tomorrow, no fears for tomorrow."
"Fitz?"
Starling drew back from me a little way.
"You sound as if you are going to do something foolish."
Her dark eyes were full of worry.
"Foolish," I said to myself. "Foolish as the fool is, yes.
Could you watch the meat, please?" I asked Starling humbly. I did not wait for her reply. I stood as she stepped free of me and went into the yurt. Kettle sat by the fool, simply watching him sleep. Ketrigan was mending a seam in her boot. They both glanced up as I came in.
"I need to talk to him," I said simply, "alone, if you would not mind."
I ignored their puzzled glances. I already wished I had not told Starling what the fool had told me. Doubtless she would tell the others, but just now I did not want to share it with them. I had something important to tell the fool, and I would do it now. I did not wait to watch them leave the yurt. Instead, I sat down beside the fool. I touched his face, gently, feeling the coolness of his cheek.
"Fool,
I said quietly. I need to talk to you. I understand. I think I finally understand what you've been trying to teach me all along. It took me several more efforts before he stirred to wakefulness. I finally shared some of Kettle's concern. This was not the simple sleep of a man at a day's end, but finally he opened his eyes and peered up at me through the gloom.
Fitz? Is it morning?
He asked. Evening. And there is fresh meat roasting, and soon it will be done. I think a good meal will help you put right. I started to hesitate, then recalled my new resolution. Now, I was angry at you earlier, for what you told me. But now I think I understand why. You are right. I have been hiding in the future and wasting my days. I took a breath. I want to give Burridge's earring over to you, into your keeping. Afterward, I'd like you to take it to him and tell him I did not die outside some shepherd's hut, but keeping my oath to my king. That will mean something to him. It may pay him back a bit for all he has done for me. He taught me to be a man. I don't want that left unsaid. I unfastened the catch of the earring and drew it from my ear. I pressed it into the fool's lax hand. He lay on his side, listening, silently. His face was very grave. I shook my head at him. I have nothing to send Molly, nothing for our child. She'll have the pin Shrewd gave me so long ago, but little more than that. I was trying to keep my voice steady, but the importance of my words was choking me. It may be wisest not to tell Molly that I lived past Regal's dungeons, if that can be managed. Burridge would understand the reason for such a secret. She has mourned me as dead once. There is no sense in telling her otherwise. I am glad you will seek her out. Make toys for Nettle. Against my will, tears stung my eyes. The fool sat up, his face full of concern. He gripped my shoulder gently.
If you want me to find Molly, you know I will, if it comes to that. But why must we think of such things now? What do you fear?
I fear my death. I admitted it, but fearing it will not stop it. So I make what provisions I can, as I should have long ago. I met his smoky eyes squarely. Promise me. He looked down at the earring in his hand.
I promise. Though why you think my chances are better than yours, I do not know, nor do I know how I will find them, but I will.
I felt great relief. I told you earlier. I know only that their cottage is near a village called Capelin Beach. There is more than one Capelin Beach in Buck, that is true, but if you tell me you will find her, I believe you will.
Capelin Beach.
His eyes went distant.
I think I recall. I thought I had dreamed that.
He shook his head and almost smiled.
So I am now a party to one of the closest-held secrets in Buck. Chade told me that not even he knew precisely where Burridge had hidden Molly away. He had only a place to leave a message for Burridge, as Burridge might come to him. The fewer who know a secret, the fewer can tell it, he told me. Yet it seems to me I have heard that name before, Capelin Beach. Or dreamed it, perhaps.
My heart went cold. What do you mean? Have you had a vision of Capelin Beach? He shook his head.
Not a vision, no. Yet a nightmare toothier than most. So that when Kettle found me and woke me, I felt I had not slept at all, but had been fleeing for my life for hours.
He shook his head again slowly and rubbed at his eyes, yawning.
I do not even recall lying down to sleep outside. But that is where they found me.
I should have known something was wrong with you. I apologized. You were by that hot spring speaking to me of Molly and things. And then you suddenly lay down and went to sleep. I thought you were mocking me. I admitted sheepishly. He gave a tremendous yawn.
I do not even recall seeking you out,
he admitted. He sniffed suddenly.
Did you say there was meat roasting?
I nodded. The wolf and I got a kid. It's young and should be tender.
I'm hungry enough to eat old shoes, he declared.
He threw back his bedding and left the tent. I followed him. The meal was a better time than we had had in days. The fool seemed weary and pensive, but had abandoned his barbed humor. The meat, though not tender as fat lamb, was better than anything we had had in weeks. By the end of the meal I shared Night-Eye's sleepy satiation. He curled up outside by Ketriken to share her watch, while I sought my blankets in the tent. I had half expected the fool to be wakeful after he had slept so much of the afternoon away. Instead, he was first to his blankets and deeply asleep before I had even dragged my boots off. Kettle set out her game cloth and gave me a problem to consider. I lay down to get what rest I could while Kettle watched over my sleep. But I got small rest that night. No sooner had I dozed off than the fool began to twitch and yip in his sleep. Even Night-Eyes poked his head in the tent door to see what it was about. It took Kettle several tries to rouse him, and when he dozed off again, he slipped right back into his noisy dreams. That time I reached over to shake him. But when I touched his shoulder, awareness of him surged through me. For an instant, I shared his night terror. "Fool, wake up!" I cried out to him, and as if in answer to that command, he sat up.
"Let go! Let go!"
he cried desperately. Then, looking round and finding that no one held him, he dropped back to his bedding. He turned his eyes to meet mine. "What were you dreaming?" I asked him. He thought, then shook his head.
"It's gone now."
He took a shuddering breath.
"But I fear it waits for me, should I close my eyes. I think I shall see if Ketriken wants some company. I would rather be awake than face whatever it was I was facing in my dreams."
I watched him leave the tent. Then I lay back in my blanket. I closed my eyes. I found it, faint as a silver shining thread. There was a skill bond between us.
"Ah, is that what that is?"
the wolf marveled.
"Can you feel it too?"
"Only sometimes. It is like what you had with Verity."
"Only weaker."
"Weaker? I think not."
Night-Eyes considered.
"Not weaker, my brother, but different. Fashioned more like a wit bond than a skill joining."
He looked up at the fool as the fool came out of the tent. After a time the fool frowned to himself and looked down at Night-Eyes.
"You see," said the wolf, "he senses me, not clearly, but he does. Hello, fool, my ears itch."
Outside the tent, the fool reached down suddenly to scratch the wolf's ears. 33. The Quarry. There are legends among the mountain folk of an ancient race much gifted with magic and knowing many things now lost to men forever. These tales are in many ways similar to the tales of elves and old ones that are told in the Six Duchies. In some cases, the tales are so similar as to be obviously the same story adapted by different folk.